So I'll start my talk on the Four Noble Truths. It's a big topic, so it will really be only an outline. And now let me get my notes up on the share. Okay. So some of you would already be familiar with this, so I apologize if I'm not giving enough detail. And on the other hand, I might get carried away and give too much detail as well. So let's see how it goes. The Buddha is supposed to have said, I teach only suffering, dukkha, and the end of suffering. Dukkha, which is a Pali word, is usually translated as suffering. But the Buddha quite deliberately gave it a much wider meaning the unsatisfactory nature of existence. I'll elaborate on that. Now, the Four Noble Truths is actually the very first discourse given by the Buddha 2,500 years ago. And this was, the first discourse after his enlightenment. It's referred to as the elephant's footprint, because it gives the framework that contains all of the other teachings of the Buddha. So all the other teachings that follow refer to some aspect of this discourse. It's also referred to as the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma. So this wheel is still turning. Now, the first discourse was actually given to five ascetics who at one point was part of the spiritual journey with him. And then he split off a little bit because he wanted to explore something a bit differently. And when he attained enlightenment, he went back to the five ascetics and shared with them what he had discovered. So since then, five disciples, it's now grown to a very much bigger following, and those following the teachings and appreciating these teachings. Now, the whole discourse is centered around dukkha, dukkha being from the grossest to the subtlest form of suffering. Now, this unfortunately makes some people say Buddhists are pessimists and sort of a miserable, gloomy lot. Now, it's actually not the case, because this has a very hopeful message, because the Buddha said what we normally take as happiness is actually very brief, very fleeting gratification. And what happens is this passes away very quickly. So then we're after the next gratification experience. So this, he said, is not a satisfactory, we are not satisfied with this experience that we cling to as giving us happiness. And he was looking for something more stable. So that was his search, was for happiness. So he describes in these Four Noble Truths, which are not just truths, meaning these are realities. These realities exist whether a Buddha is alive and teaching or not. These are realities which a Buddha discovers and explains to others. So it's not his discovery, but it became a revelation to him through his practice, through meditation. So the basic summary is that the four truths are, firstly, dukkha, suffering. Secondly, its origin, which is mainly to do with craving. Thirdly, that there is cessation. And this cessation is, of course, comes through the relinquishing of craving. But it doesn't just happen like that, just because we want it to. There is a path to be followed, to be developed, which leads us to the relief and the liberation from suffering, So I will give a description of each of those four, not so much the fourth one because I'm going to talk about it next week, but I'll start from the go through numbers 1, 2, and 3, especially. Now, I have to say that coming from a medical background, I really appreciate this structure because what he's done is he's given us the diagnosis of human suffering, dukkha. Then he goes on to say, this is the etiology, this is the origin of this suffering. Then he says, actually, the prognosis is good, provided you follow the treatment. And then he outlines the treatment in detail. So it makes sense to me, and I think it makes sense to other people as well, that there's this a quite a logical order to all of this. Now, the noble truth of dukkha, the unsatisfactory nature that is intrinsic to our existence, he said, is to be fully understood. This is not to be glossed over. We have to see this deeply if this path is to me, if we are to follow this path, and if we are seeking some spiritual path that is going to bring us relief. So in summary, I'm quoting from the sutta here, birth, aging, illness, and death. This is sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. This is suffering. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. And then he makes this statement, which I will have to explain later. In brief, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. So let me go back to the first part, which he talks of as dukkha dukkata. In other words, this is obvious dukkha. Nobody is going to say this is not suffering in some form. Birth, aging, illness, death lead to both physical and emotional suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And he said these are occasional dukkha experiences. Then he talks about these other ones, which he said are frequent experience of encounters with dukkha. Separation from what is pleasing, those we love or situations we enjoy. You know, we all have experienced this, whether it's a separation by through death of someone we love, or a partner where the partnership has gone awry, or we have a good job and suddenly we don't have it anymore for whatever reason. So we are often separated from things, but they may be small separations, not, you know, not very distressing ones. So you have this subtle level of suffering, which sometimes we don't even recognize as suffering and unsatisfactory. It's just something we get on with and we get stressed about and we don't think much more about it unless it really impacts us. So being in a situation that, or with people that we don't find pleasant to be with, this is also stressful. Not getting what we want, which happens often, is also stressful. Sometimes getting what one wants is also stressful. So these are occasional dukkha, which everybody will experience as some form of stress at least. When I'll come to this five aggregates in a bit, but then there's, he said, another level of dukkha, which is a little bit more subtle. He said dukkha due to the fact that there is change. And these are overt change, macroscopic changes that he's talking about. So when we are young and healthy and fit, it's great. But there's a shadow there, which says, well, it's not always going to be like this. Something happens, we break a leg, or some disease happens to a friend or to yourself. So there's always this shadow, which makes it just not perfect or just not completely satisfactory. So aging, changes, all of these things, there's this shadow of change that hangs over us. So even when we are happy and you know, very upbeat and so on. And we think, oh, this is going to last. Here's the my soulmate. This relationship's going to last, etc. But it doesn't quite remain like that because there are changes, because this is the nature of life. And that shadow, even when we are happy, then makes the dukkha emerge in that experience. Now, this one is the subtlest, this last one, is the subtlest form of dukkha. And what it means, the Buddha said that we, that you and me, we are basically made up of five aggregates, five lumps of factors. And he said there's the physical factors, this body, and then he said there are mental processes. So we are a mind-body process. The mental factors, he said, are feelings, perceptions, thoughts, and consciousness. So he said there is nothing enduring here. These factors, this physical, mental, mind-body process is constantly in flux. It's every moment it's changing. When we started this talk to now, there's been a lot of change, but we don't see it because we cannot perceive it with our untrained mind. But of course, you take a photograph now and 5 years time, I can see, yes, I have changed. Of course, it didn't happen overnight. It was happening all the time. It's happening right now. So because of this, the Buddha said, there is absolutely nothing for us to hang on to as something secure. There isn't. So this is a reality. So when we can see the dukkha deeply, it actually, people say, oh, that's really depressing. Well, I can tell you as a psychiatrist, one of the most useful things I have found is this first noble truth. Because I find that when I'm depressed or things aren't working, I listen to a talk on dukkha, on the Four Noble Truths. Why? Because suddenly there's all this detail about dukkha as a reality of existence. And then suddenly I realize, hey, this is not a Gita thing. This is a universal thing. You know, this is how it is. And bit by bit, you kind of understand, oh, okay, it's not a surprise when these things happen. But of course, you try to find some way of relief and coming to terms with it and so on. But knowing that this is a universal phenomenon is actually great relief. So anyway, it's quite a lot to understand. Most of it, though, we can understand intellectually, but then there are some things, the subtler aspects, we will only understand once the actual pathway is developed. Until then, we won't see it directly, but we'll know intellectually. Now, the second noble truth is the origin of suffering, craving. And the Pali word is tanha, which actually means thirst. So this is a desperate, desperate craving. You know what it's like when you're thirsty. You will even drink salt water because that's how strong this urge is. And he said, we crave for many things, but one lot of things is sense pleasure. We are forever trying to find pleasure and avoid displeasure. So we are bouncing between these two all the time, in small ways and in big ways. I was trying to give up chocolate for a reason, medical reason recently, and boy, it was really, really difficult. And I'm thinking, how do people who are addicted to things give these things up? You know, here's a good reason requiring me to give it up for a short, hopefully short period of time, but it's still difficult. And there's all these excuses the mind comes up with not to let go of it, you know? So sense pleasure is a big thing. And sights, sounds, touch, fantasies, all these things give us sense pleasure. Then the second thing is our craving for existence. We want to live, and we really know it when something goes wrong with the body, when you're diagnosed with something or someone close to you, you know, suddenly you realize what lengths you will go to preserve this life. This is precious. and you will go to many, much, you know, whatever extent you can. So there's this craving for existence. Then he said there's also a craving for non-existence. You see, sometimes life does become very difficult and unbearable, and the extreme form of that is suicide. So he said there is that too. And in all of this, we are constantly looking for things to be a bit different than they actually are. It's just not quite right. Even the best dinner cooked by, you know, the best chef, it's one, it's going to be finished soon. Two, you know, it could have just a little bit of more of this or that. So there's never this totally satisfying experience. So we keep searching for this, I don't know, this perfect experience. And the driver for all of this, underneath all of this, the Buddha said, is this illusion of self. Now, this illusion is formed by the five aggregates. They come together, they're operating together all the time. And I think, well, that's me. You know, this is me, this is mine. So this me, I want this. This is reinforced because it appears that we are a solid entity. We don't see that this is just a flux, a process in flux. So we have this notion of self, and we are driven by that self towards greed and hatred and a variety of delusions. So this is the origin of suffering. Now, if we can relinquish or somehow dissolve this craving and the clinging that goes with it, that leads to the cessation of dukkha, to nibbana. This is easier said than done. So the Buddha then goes on to lay out a path, which he says, this path, this middle path, this noble eightfold path, is to be developed. Each one has to develop it for themselves until that path matures into the what is called the Aryan path. It's not a mundane path anymore. It's a noble path, which is the path to enlightenment. We start with the mundane path, and then it evolves with practice and development. Now, I'll just show you very quickly this Noble Eightfold Path, which some of us have been no doubt practicing over many lives. We're still doing it. Now, you might see this wheel up at the top. This is the wheel of the Dhamma. And when it's given with eight spokes, that refers to the Eightfold Path. Now, all the spokes have to come together. So it's not a sequential path where you go through the first, the second, all of these sequentially. It all has to be developed. And as it's developed, each aspect that you develop enhances the others. Now, the Buddha talked about three categories that he falls, these path factors fall into. Firstly, the wisdom factors, right view, right intention. Without a basic right view and right intention, you wouldn't even want to embark on the path. But we'll get to that, what makes people embark on this path. Then we have the virtue factors, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Most of you would have heard about the five precepts that the Buddha recommends, that it's a training or in five disciplines that we undertake, not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to engage in lies, false speech, and not to engage in intoxicating things. So these are actually kind of covered in this virtue section, the five precepts. And the other thing is that really, without a basis in virtue, you cannot develop meditation. So it's really important. And most of the time, this is our beginning of our path, the practice of path. Then we have the meditation, the samadhi group, where right effort to develop wholesome factors, right mindfulness, sati. This is a hugely important factor, and it's kind of factor that keeps all the other factors in balance. And then it deepens, you develop the right concentration, which can become extremely deep to jhana states. And with that, you have the penetrating capacity of the mind to see those subtle changes that I was talking about before. So when the path matures, then you experience the path of liberation. And that is through direct insight, not just through intellectual understanding, but through direct insight into the true nature of existence, which he said was impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and no self. If we can see this in a microscopic, immediate way, we are now onto the path of liberation. So that's, in a nutshell, the Four Noble Truths. And I could take one question maybe before we go to the meditation. Catherine, is that all right?
Absolutely. If I can just suggest at this point, any question be focused on the Four Noble Truths. Afterwards, it's fine to sort of open up a little bit, but if we can stay, somebody has a question connected to that, that sounds terrific.
I can clarify straight away if there's a burning question, I hope.
It might be good to stop sharing the screen and then we can see a little easier. So feel free to raise the hand.
It's a lot of condensed information, which takes a long time to kind of percolate and digest and practice.
May I ask?
Yes.
Okay, so you said that without virtue cannot develop in meditation, and yet it is not a sequential path, which I totally understand, nor is it ever going to stop, you know, if one wants to continue living well and be free from suffering and all that. But is there a suggestion about where to start?
Well, actually, we start from many places. If you follow the five precepts every day, not to kill, not to steal, right? Not to engage in sexual misconduct.
Intoxicants
guarded about your speech. You're already training in this path. Maybe not consciously, but you are. And then you develop it more, because what starts with do not kill actually develops into loving kindness, where you do not want to hurt any other creatures, any other beings. But he says the bottom line is you're not to kill. Or you have to train yourself that way. So that's your bottom line. And then you build from there. So all of the precepts are like that. It's a training process. And virtue is important, yes.
That is very helpful. Thank you.
And I think I agree with you, Martha, that it is a work in progress for life. It's an absolutely fascinating work in progress, this path. Yeah, it's for life.
You cannot win no other way. As are all intoxicants, like you can't take anything at all? Mm-hmm. I mean, my thought is this, if I take something and I don't feel well, or I feel buffered, and it leads me to do unskillful things, that's probably what tells me when I need to stop. What are your thoughts about that?
The reason for saying not to take intoxicating things is because it leads to heedlessness, because it leads to lack of awarenessness. Now, awareness, is key to this whole path. So you don't want to do anything that clouds the awareness. However, when people often ask, can't I just have a glass of wine, you know, once a week with a meal? So this is a training process. You decide where you can start, what is realistic for you, and you develop from there. And then comes the point when you say, well, actually, I don't actually need that glass of wine. Why do I need it? You start to question these things. So at that point, you say, okay, I'll have a glass of water or a cup of tea. You know, it's, you develop it, you train yourself. Yeah. It's not a commandment.
No, thank you for that. Yeah, I have, you know, I get disturbed in response to taste. I love the way it tastes, but it does cloud the judgment. And then too, I just have difficulty not overdoing it. So thank you.
Don't see any other hands. So, oh, there is a hand. You have to unmute, Amanda. You have to unmute.
Oh, no, sorry, I didn't raise my hand. I really enjoyed learning this tonight. From the books I've read, it just added more. I don't mean to say badly, but it was in a simple step-by-step form, which was really good. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to give a structure so people can fill it in as you go along, as your interest takes you to more reading and more talks to listen to, etc. Oh, Cheryl. That is definitely a hand. So you have to unmute.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah.
I was just wondering if it was possible to get a copy of the presentation tonight.
Yes, of course. I can send it to Marlene and let her send it on to you.
Thank you very much.
So Gita, should we move on to the meditation or?
Yeah, good idea. Yeah.
Okay. There's going to be a lot of opportunity after we settle in and meditate to ask further questions of Gita. So before we settle down for about 30 minutes of sitting meditation or lying meditation, whatever your body needs tonight. If you need to stand up and arrange the body, feel free to do that. Rearrange the body. And I thought that following on from Gita's presentation of the Four Noble Truths, it might be interesting to bring to tonight's meditation an orientation of observing the experience that we have in the next 30 minutes with a question of, where's dukkha here? Is dukkha here? Where's craving here? Is craving here? Remembering that, as Gita and Richard last week as well also spoke about, craving can be wanting something that we don't have and also not wanting something that we do have. And also observing how it comes and goes, and what happens. So bringing that orientation of investigation, of curiosity, as we meditate. So we're bringing a little bit of an investigation, perhaps more than we do in a straight samatha practice where we are orienting towards tranquility. I'm inviting, if that works for you, and feel free not to follow this if it doesn't, just to open up to this moment. So you might settle into the body, feel into the body, have a sense of presence, of ease, because we don't want the investigation to become too tight and we don't want that to get in the way. So allowing a settling, allowing ease to be here, but also inviting curiosity. And as you observe this experience in this moment, with the different elements that Gita spoke of, the body, the mind, it's very lightly holding that question, Is there anything unsatisfactory here? Maybe noticing if there's ever so subtly a pushing away and not wanting of something, or a wanting of something else that's not here. Feel free to anchor the attention on the breath or the body, if that supports your practice. And allowing or encouraging curiosity to accompany this unfolding present moment. And we're investigating our experience to support wisdom rather than to judge what we observe. Bringing a little kindness to this process can also be skillful. Maybe as you observe your experience in the body, there's a little niggle or a discomfort. a simple experience of dukkha. And then maybe you notice there's also a wanting it to be different. Some craving for a different experience. Or maybe the mind is restless or busy or drowsy. And as you observe that, you notice also some craving for it to be different, even if it's only subtle. And feeling the dukkha involved in that craving for a different experience. And how does remembering that dukkha is just part of this human existence? How does that wise reflection maybe alter the experience? if you notice some wanting the experience that you're having to be different or resisting what is here, is it possible to soften that resistance, to ease back on that wanting, maybe even touching a little cessation of the dukkha? knowing the very naturalness of dukkha in certain conditions are met, it will arise. When they cease, it too will cease. There's always the opportunity to make peace with any dukkha that's present. And in a few moments, I'll ring the bell 3 times. Bring this practice to a close. And so I pass over, back over to Gita. It's a good sign when people are silent after meditation. The mind has settled so much that it's just like an effort to speak, or, you know, it's just the mind just wants to stay settled, experiencing that peace and quiet stillness. I think this is an opportunity for questions, is that correct, Peter?
Yes. So while people are thinking about a question, I'll make a comment, if I may. Going back to the question of precepts, there's a couple of things. When we develop these precepts to develop virtue, the Buddha said there's 2 things about these precepts. You develop them out of wisdom for your own benefit, and out of compassion for the benefit of others. So the precepts training is undertaken for both reasons. And as a result, the practice of the development of virtues, these precepts, he said, is a gift. This is a gift from you to yourself and a gift from you to the others in your community, because it makes for a safer, more harmonious, more peaceful community if nobody is stealing, killing, intoxicated, all these things. That it's a gift. So this is described as one of the gifts. And I remind people at Christmas that if you're really looking for presents, here's a nice gift. Yeah.
I do have a question. I'm wondering, you know, you said when you feel disturbed or upset or unsettled or unbalanced, you listen to a Dharma talk on the Four Noble Truths. Is there a specific one that you go to? That would be helpful, because it is helpful for me to remember, you know, right, this is just suffering. This is just craving. It's not a huge deal. It'll go away. I've got to change that. That may or may not need to happen, or I've got to get that. That may or may not be great for me. It is helpful to know that. But I can't always meditate my way through it because I get so nervous and so anxious. And so sometimes filling my mind with thought instead of just being aware when I'm in a really, really, really anxious state is very helpful. That's one reason why I'm here now, is because I'm filling my mind with something wholesome and helpful instead of clinging to my perseverative thoughts about my pain and how can I make it stop. So I'm just wondering if there is a specific Dharma talk that you go to that you said you listened.
I think what happens is over time you kind of select what works for you. The talk that I listen to is a talk by Bhikkhu Bodhi. He has translated all of the main Buddhist discourses to English. And his lecture, there's a free lecture series that you can download from the website from Bhikkhu Bodhi. And this, out of the 10 lectures, I think this is the second lecture, the Four Noble Truths. And I have it on my phone. And I do listen to it quite often. And I only have to listen to up to the end of the first Noble Truth. And I think, right, got it. I'm back on track. Because it helps you to not be identified with whatever the gripe that you're struggling with at the time. You realize, yes, this is an unpleasant feeling. I'm getting anxious. I'm getting despondent, whatever. You start listening. Hang on a minute. Let's just listen to the first noble truth, because I think I'm right in the middle of it. Okay, so I switch on the talk and I just listen to the various aspects of the first note of dukkha, and it becomes clear that there's no need to identify with this process as mine. This is my dukkha. This is my problem. This is this one's experience, yes. But this is a universal experience. And everybody, every being is undergoing this experience in one form or another. I just happen to have got this particular experience at that particular time. This all belongs to the same group of dukkha. So that has been my go-to talk for the last 10 years. So, but you'll find, and he does talks now, which are videos. So you can actually go to his introductory talks on Buddhism. They're more than introductory, actually, but they're videos. So you can actually see him explaining things on the whiteboard and so on. So it's clearer because it's quite condensed. And you'll also find tracks of meditation that help you as well. If you go to different tracks, I find sometimes Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen master who died about 6-7 months ago, just that loving kindness that you pick up just watching him, and then of course following the mindfulness meditation, it just helps you to embrace the suffering rather than trying to get rid of it. And as you embrace it and you're just allowing it to be, what arises passes away. And lo and behold, the same thing happens to your suffering. It arose and you're just holding it there and it passes away. So that allowing it to be, just being aware, you don't have to do anything. That's the magic of awareness. You don't have to do anything. You just have to know this is how it is. So you don't dwell on the story. Oh, I could have done this. I could have done this. Nah, this is a painful feeling.
I think I found the thing on the internet, and that is helpful. Because what ends up happening is I will go to meditation talks, but sometimes I get real frustrated. I don't know which one to go to, and technology is not working and it makes it worse. So that would be helpful, I think, for me to identify one specific one to go back to. So number two on that Bodhi Bhikkhu Bodhi thing. I think that would be helpful. And I think I just found it. And then what was the other thing? Oh yeah. I'm not ready to embrace the pain. But I've just noticed recently that I really, really push against it. So I'm right now working on not pushing against, just not pushing against it, not trying to wrench my attention back to the breath, or because I can't really embrace it per se in that sense of, oh, I love you. I just can't do it. But that is helpful to know that everyone else is going through it. Thank you. I'm sorry. I don't mean to take up everybody's time. This is extremely helpful. I really appreciate being with people who are studying this. Thank you.
It's not even loving the pain. It's allowing this to be as it is. Just observing. It is difficult though when you're in the middle of it. You mentioned a very important word, wholesome. Because sometimes, and the Buddha says, if you do things with your mind, your speech, or your body, based on wholesome roots, the whole term, three wholesome roots, generosity, loving kindness, and non-delusion, wisdom, right? Those are the wholesome roots. The unwholesome roots of activity are the opposite: greed, hatred, delusion. Right? So if he says, if you do anything, thought, word, or deed, based from a wholesome root, it's going to result in a wholesome consequence. Now, you don't have to wait till the next life. It happens right now. So when you said, you know, I try to turn my attention to something wholesome, this is actually very important, because you may have to do something like get up, go for a walk, just lift your mind with what there is around you, nature, whatever. It may be that you do some act of generosity, or you maybe find some opportunity for being with a friend that you enjoy, or loving kindness, some aspect like that. And often people with who've been practicing Buddhist teachings for some time, they will just reflect on things like the five precepts, or they will reflect on the qualities of the Buddha, or they'll reflect on what's called going for the refuges, the three refuges, the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I go to the Buddha for refuge, I go to the Dhamma for refuge, I go to the Sangha for refuge. It doesn't mean that they're going to suddenly come out from somewhere and protect you or something, but it's your inspiration. This is your guide. So immediately you find, if you do these sorts of things through the day here and there, there's a little bit of wholesomeness. And you do this for a few days and you think, oh, I feel a bit kind of happy. Why is that? I think, okay, I know what I've been doing. So the wholesomeness has wholesome consequences. And reducing the unwholesome also has its benefits. So listening to the Dhamma, recorded, pre-recorded, whatever, that works for you, is a wholesome act. Just a half an hour of wholesome food for the mind makes a difference.
Gita, some days I notice that there's just an underlying, but not, I can't put my finger on the unsatisfactoriness of my experience. There's nothing going wrong. There's just this sort of underlying complaining sense in the mind. Without anything particular it's complaining about. I don't know if there's anything, any thoughts or reflections on that, mm-hmm. that you might have.
Yeah. I think the most important thing is that you notice, you become aware that there is a kind of a feeling here. And that's all, it's just right? You can't put your finger on it, but it's just a unpleasant feeling. That's maybe the best you can do. And you accept that there is this unpleasant feeling. That's the reason. And you'll come back to that. That's all it is. There's no detail to it. There's no story. It's just an unpleasant feeling. And there may be many factors there that have contributed which we are not aware of. But in a way, it doesn't matter. Because whatever they are, they will arise, they will pass away. I can give you an example of my experience or something similar. After my parents died, there was a lot of grief and emptiness. And all I could feel was this empty hole inside my chest. And I was just thinking, it's just this, And then I was just watching it and just daring to just face that empty, awful, unpleasant feeling. And I was just staring at it, kind of, you know, in my mind. And after a while, it's gone. And I'm thinking, what happened? Where is it? Because it's passed away. It hasn't been fed anything extra. So this arose, it passes away. Because that's all you did. You did nothing. You just noted it as an unpleasant feeling. You're not resisting it. You were not enjoying it. You knew that. And when it happened a few times, I thought, I know what to do with this. Stare right at it. Just go right with it. And I knew that if I just exactly hit that spot of mindfulness, total mindfulness, without rejecting it, without doing anything with it, it just goes seriously. And I think in a way I was kind of starting to manipulate that experience, which is not necessarily saying it's a good thing, but it's just the knowing that if you can meet it completely, fully, full on mindfulness, it just goes. Because I think the mind can only accept, you know, the mind experiences moment to moment to moment. It's not a continuous thing. It's arising, passing away, arising, passing away. But because we're feeding it either with fear, oh my goodness, this is going to last for the rest of my life, we are building more fuel on it by resisting it. But just that waiting and watching, you know, you discover that moment of mindfulness where you just meet it head on. That's the only way I can put it. There's no aggression there. It's just a total And problem is, of course, then it became where I was waiting for it to go. That's not acceptance. So, you know, you kind of realize, hey, I'm cheating here. You know? But then you let go of that. So that's complete mindfulness of citta, the mind state. Just that, the mind. This is the mind state. Just some subtle unpleasantness. If you keep doing that, I know I was one time I was actually thinking, I can zap this with mindfulness, you know. Because that's what happens. It just gets zapped. Don't set out to do it, but, you know, that's what happens. And sometimes in meditation experiences where, you know, you come to some sort of pain or the whole body's hurting and you think, there's nothing I can do about this, whether I move or I don't move. It's just everywhere, right? And I have come times when I have just couldn't do anything except, no, this is this unpleasant experience and there's nothing I can do. I'm just going to sit here. There's no resistance after that. And suddenly I'm finding, there's no pain. What happened? You know, the mind is now connecting to a different object. It's no longer connected with pain as an object. The mind only can experience the object it connects with.
We are getting close to the end, but I'm also interested, Geeta, if you, how you might discuss the understanding of suffering with somebody who isn't immersed in a Buddhist understanding of suffering, because it in some ways feels quite countercultural. So I don't know if there's any wisdom that you might be able to share with us about speaking about this very inevitability of dukkha and the acceptance around that with people who don't have an interest in Dharma.
Yeah, sometimes this is when you come up against, you know, you pessimistic Buddhists, you know, kind of, you know, why do you have to think about suffering all the time and so on. I think you have to know whether that person is receptive and looking for some way of understanding whatever they're going through, because it's when somebody's, you know, there's some crisis of some sort where people then look to, how can I deal with this? But the person has to be receptive. I don't tend to broach the subject anymore of suffering unless someone broaches it with me. And people who have no interest in a spiritual path necessarily, sometimes they're in situations where this comes up, so, you know, about suffering. And if they know that I have some interest in Buddhism, then it's more likely for them to bring it up. I found that before my retirement, I was working in palliative care. Sometimes people would ask whether I had a spiritual background. Unless I was asked, I would never reveal that I had an interest in Buddhist meditation or anything. But sometimes they would talk about suffering and I would go with that conversation. Yes, what do they make of it and how do they deal with it? And so sometimes I have people who then come up with these insights that are entirely theirs. And I'm thinking, you've been reading about anicca, dukkha, anatta, you know, because they have come to that themselves, you know, and I think, wow, you know, this is someone who's seen it for themselves, some aspects of it. And I say, well, this is how it is. And yeah, peace, then the peace that follows it. Some person who was at reasonably quite close to terminal stages is saying to me, you know, I'm 75, I never thought I was going to die. He said, isn't that ridiculous? Isn't that the most ridiculous thing? He said, and my wife, I better ring her right now and tell her this is what's ahead of us, you know. It was like this revelation. And suddenly, you know, it was there and said, you know, I have to come to terms with this. I'm dying, aren't I? Yes. And I said, and my wife, she hasn't thought of this either. He was a patient from the country, so he was impatient to get on the phone and tell his wife, hey, have you thought about this? So people come to the Dhamma, you know, in all sorts of ways. Yeah, I'm wary about broaching it unless I feel a real opening.
A lot of wisdom in that, I think, yes. Well, I noticed the time, and I do want to thank Geeta on behalf of all of us for a really interesting exploration today, starting with the first three noble truths in particular, and we will continue with the fourth next week.
That's right.
And yeah. So many thanks, Geeta, and thank you everybody for coming and joining us and being part of this group together to explore and continue our practice. Coming together is such an important part of developing wisdom and compassion and patience and all of these things that are part of the path that we'll hear more about next week. So thank you all. And thanks, Marlene, as always, for the terrific coordination of the group. Have a good night or morning or whatever it is where you are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Geeta. Thank you, Catherine, too. Much appreciated.